Nobody covers dog sledding like Mushing from First Paw Media. Our team of athletes, volunteers, race organizers, and mushers like Robert and Michelle Forto brings you closer to the sport. If it's happening, we are there. Live from the qualifying races in January and February, the Iditarod in March, and in the summer, Mushing takes you on the road with our team and trail tour. We connect you with a history of the sport, in-depth interviews with the top mushers, and great storytelling and breaking news all year long. Follow on Mushing.com.
Hello and welcome, everybody. This is Robert Forto, and you're listening to the Mushing Podcast. And I am joined again today by Rod Perry. And this guy, what a storyteller. I'm looking forward to jumping into this again. If you haven't had a chance to listen to the first episode in this series, you want to go check it out. Hit that pause button. Go over and check it out right on the feed. It's about how the first Iditarod possibly did not even occur. So, Rod, welcome back to the show. How are you today?
I'm doing wonderfully. Thank you.
Well, thanks again for joining us. I'm looking forward to this. As we talked about there on that quick intro, we were leading up to the first Iditarod in 1973. We set the scene, told a little bit of the history, but we're going to jump right into the race. And I know you were a participant in that 1973 race. So let's start it off. Tell us about the 1973 Iditarod.
Okay. I just gave former Senator and Mayor Mark Begich a newspaper, the old Eagle River Star, featuring me on the front cover. And it showed me at the starting line getting ready to take my countdown and head out. And I said that at that historic moment, the photo was taken, the Iditarod Trail sled dog race phenomenon, which would soon become world famous and a sparkling facet in Alaska's image and part of the 49th state's very brand, was only 29 minutes old. So Bud Smith had left first carrying the flag, very first racer ever in long distance racing history. And I was bound to take off at minute 30. And so, by the way, the 1973 and 74 races were noteworthy as the only Iditarods that would cover the entire Anchorage to Nome distance by dog power alone with no vehicular interruption to motor teams ahead to a restart. And of course, now in 2026, along with five others, I'm one of only six of the men of 73 that are still living.
Interesting. So, let's jump into the start here pretty quickly, and then I want to go back a little bit to how you prepared for it. So on that 1973 race, as I mentioned in the last episode, I was a youngster. I was only 2 years old, so I didn't have any idea about the Iditarod at that point. But can you set the scene for us? What was it like there in downtown Anchorage? And I'm sure, you know, a lot of people follow the race today. At this recording, it's going to start tomorrow downtown there. What was the atmosphere like? Of course, the Rondi had been going on for many years before that in a very similar fashion.
Yeah, the race did not start downtown for a few years. In fact, some of the downtown businessmen did not want us to start down there, and they resisted it because they thought that it tied up traffic and tied up business. So the first race began at Tudor Track, later to become renamed Tozier Track. And we followed the Rendezvous trail from Tudor Track out around the pole line to Muldoon, and then on past Eagle River to the west of Eagle River, out on the military lands and railroad lands, skirted around past Eklutna, and then across the Kinnick River Bridge and on to the first checkpoint, Kinnick, 60 trail miles, some said 65, from Tudor Track. And And so the scene there at Tudor Track was electric, but I would say at the most, maybe there was only maybe at the most, maybe 200 people there.
Okay.
So, Anchorage wasn't waking up yet to the Iditarod.
Yeah. It was a new thing on the horizon there. So tell us a little bit about your dogs, your gear. What were you wearing to start that race? Obviously now everybody has really fancy gear, $1,000 parkas and fancy hats and, you know, the best gloves and boots and all of that. I've seen pictures over the years in Team and Trail and Mushing Magazine. What was the setup like?
The field was drawn from the ranks of the ready. And that meant, you know, native Athabascans and Inupiats, a couple of Yupiks, right in off the hunt and trap line. We all wore what we already had, pretty much. I had a sponsorship for Ron Aldrich and me from Trailwise, one of the pioneering outdoor, mountaineering equipment manufacturers. And we got a couple of parkas, an inner parka, outer parka. And those were of down. Anyway, it was a mishmash. There wasn't any standardization like you see today. Certainly the contestants didn't look like they do today, right off the cover of a North Face catalog. It was very rough. It was so colorful. It was so colorful. I don't mean colors of the color spectrum. to see the native drivers and all of the different sleds, and there was no standardization yet. There was nobody. The racers of today stand on our shoulders. There was no shoulders to stand on. There were people that had driven pretty long distances, but never raced long distances. And people just brought what they had. The sleds were broken and mended. The parkas were torn and patched. Harnesses were trail worn. The dogs were trail toughened. It was just an entirely different look and atmosphere. The race has really lost its color in that way.
Right. So tell us about the dogs. How many dogs did you start with? And briefly tell us about where these guys came from. Did you have, I know we talked briefly about that in the first episode. Did you have your own lines? Were these all your own dogs? Were you borrowing dogs? That sort of thing.
I was making my motion picture sourdough. Those of your followers that want to Google that could get in an interesting watch on YouTube. But anyway, I was totally involved in that, and I really couldn't invest in the Iditarod much at all. I just had to go, though. I had a little team for the motion picture, but most of those dogs were old dogs, incapable of making it all the way. So I had part of that team, and I just started throwing together this mishmash of dogs. I went to the pound. I got calls off race teams. I answered one ad in the newspaper for a family pet that people had that were rotating outside in the military and couldn't keep him. And I had about 150 miles on that dog before the race. He ended up being one of my best dogs. But man, did I have to really lay back and get my team in shape on the way. Fortunately, I'd been a competitive athlete and just kind of knew physiology and knew that I had to ease way back. You had to make it to Kinnick within 24 hours of heading out or you were called from the race. That was the version of the qualifying races of today. And so, that dog with 150 miles on it put practically half of his entire experience in harness on him in one day. Obviously I had to ease way back on that dog and some of the others, but I had borrowed dogs and it was really, really something. Of the bunch, I had really five really good dogs.
So a lot of people learn about and talk about lead dogs. Can you recall your primary leaders on that team? And were they pretty trail hardened, as you said? I mean, did they know all the commands? Did they listen? That sort of thing?
I had what for a few years was the most famous sled dog on earth.
Okay.
And his name was Fat Albert. So written up in Sports Illustrated, the Wall Street Journal, the National Observer. That's a Wall Street Journal weekly news magazine. And they covered him 12 straight weeks. Reader's Digest, on and on. The dog was a genius, and he wasn't the greatest dog in the race. It's just that coming back from the first Iditarod, I wrote the first story to ever see international print on the race. There have been thousands since. That was a trailbreaker in and of itself. It was the first, and it's still the longest two-part article in the history of Alaska Magazine. So anyway, that dog was amazing. My brother went out on a little training run with me, and he said, "Rod, this is such a scroungy team you've got together. Without that dog, you have no prayer to make it to Nome." And he was right. So he led me all the way.
Oh my goodness! For our youngsters, they probably don't even know what the name Fat Albert means. It was a cartoon, maybe later than this, that was on, somehow associated with Bill Cosby. Very popular. Yeah. I remember watching that with a kid. Did it relate somehow to that?
Yeah. I bought the dog, I think, for $50 or $60 from Ron Aldrich's neighbor, a fellow homesteader farther up the little homestead road. From Ron's, Susie Blankenship had gone on to college, and she's really felt bad leaving her pet back home, just languishing. And she wrote her mom and said, "Mom, why don't you see if Rod Perry might like to have Fat Albert?" And so I bought him for $60, and I tried that dog, and he had picked up the commands from back in the team. He had picked up those commands so completely. He was amazing. And for a big dog like he was, bigger than most of the dogs in the Iditarod race, he was built just right to get the most out of his size. And toward the end of the race, now this is nothing today, but back then it was amazing. With five dogs, I went out and made the run from Unalakleet to Koyuk in one day. That's 90 miles or so. And that was a noteworthy occurrence on the first Iditarod race. They also had a prize that Bud Smith had originated, a little race at the end of the race to see who had the fastest time from Solomon, which was the checkpoint before safety. It was about 30 miles out from Solomon to Nome. With those five dogs, I was the third fastest.
And they still give an award something similar to that today. The fastest time from safety to Nome, I believe, is the award. And it's typically not the winner of the race that gets that. I know Bud Smith's son, Ramey Smith, has won that award a few times. He was often running in the Iditarod at the later stages in his tennis shoes. Definitely different gear, I'm sure, than what you were using back in the day. But let's back up a little bit. You said you had to do the first leg of the race, that first 60 miles from Anchorage to Kinnick, in 24 hours. That seems like a very long time to me to run 60 miles, but obviously that was uncharted territory at the time. So obviously you made it through there. Let's break down the first race a little bit before we spend all of our time here on the first Iditarod. What was it like out there on the trail for the first time? It definitely was uncharted territory for all of you guys. What was that first race like?
Well, it was just incredible. Nobody knew each other's teams. Of course, there was George Atla in the field and Isaac Oklisik, a few people that some recognized, a little bit lesser. You had to be pretty much a fan of the Rondi type races to have recognized Herbie Nyakpuk. He had never placed way, way up high. There were a few other people that had run the Rendezvous kind of as also rans, like Dick Mackey and Terry Miller and a few others, but mainly they were unknowns from way out in the distant bush. And out there, they were pretty much known because village racing was still going on even after the coming of the snowmobile and after almost all of the villagers had divested themselves of their dog teams. And so people out there knew these contestants, but nobody else did. It was just a total unknown. And so we took off out of Anchorage, skirted the backside of Anchorage, you know, the pole line pass, you know, in back of Muldoon, and went on out. We crossed the Kinnick River Bridge, the Aurora Sled Dog Club that really was the kind of the founding parent club of the Iditarod. They helped people across the bridge. And so that went on for 2 years. After that, the Department of Highways decided no more. And so that's what started the pickup and the, you know, jaunt ahead by vehicle to a restart. And at first it was, you know, on to Kinnick. But by being able to cross the Kinnick River Bridge, it got you across what otherwise was impassable. The earthquake had lowered the land there, and it was subject to tides that would break up the ice. Also, since the Gold Rush days, there'd been the power station up there at Eklutna and feeding warm water into the Kinnick River. And so there was no, you know, no ice crossing. You had to use the bridge. And without the bridge, when they ended that, they ended Anchorage to Nome in one shot. So I was fortunate. A few of the others of us, Dick Mackey, Ron Aldrich, Dan Seavey, got to run the first two races. And by the way, that was so valuable to us because, like, I was visiting with Dick Mackey at last year's picnic. I said, Dick, I don't know if you've ever encountered this, but in talking to a lot of the old timers that ran some of the first races, they nod their heads like they know all about the first race because they ran, say, the fourth or the fifth one. And ours must have been just kind of, you can see in their eyes or in what they say, they consider ours kind of being a distinction without a difference, that theirs was just like ours. And I asked Dick if he'd ever encountered that. He goes, oh, yeah. He says, they ain't got a clue.
So you guys,
the first race was so different.
So you guys are out there. You made it past the population centers, if you will. You're out there alone now on this quest. You know, passing your way through. Again, forgive my ignorance here, but once you got to Kinnick, did you go up the same sort of trail that they do now with Yetna and Squintna, then on over the range, or how was it different from that?
Way different, I should say. That when Timberland was considering being a sponsor, they needed the guy that was really spurring that said to Greg Bill, the old development director, Greg, we need somebody to come back to headquarters and convince all these old men that don't know anything about the race that this is a good idea. And Greg sent Dick Mackey. Dick Mackey told a story that just had these guys' eyes, you know, mouths dropping open. And I've often said that as the racers the next morning headed out off of the connected highway system, and they went the length of Kinnick Lake, climbed the little hill into the birch forest, it was as if all wild Alaska was grinning with a devilish mirth, jaws open, devouring teams and men. And into this great unknown, and Dick told about two women, wives of these men, and those men weren't like today's racers. Those guys were people that a lot of them pitted their lives every day against Alaska's elements in what they did. And here these wives inured to having husbands that, you know, leaving them each morning into such danger. Two of them were crying, being consoled by friends, fearing they would never see their husbands alive again. And so we disappeared into the bush and headed out. The trail went through Susitna Station and took the old Rabbit Lake Trail, the original way that the old Iditarod Trail followed, and that trail came out up the Squintna River a ways and didn't go through the Yentna or the Lake Creek Lodge or any of those. It's just an older established, it started out as an Indian trail, headed out. It came out up there at Squintna. We went through Squintna and then on to Finger Lake and the way the race goes now. And of course it did not go through Nikolai the first year. It went to Farewell Lake Lodge and it went from there past Big River. There used to be a roadhouse there, and then on to McGrath. And Ophir was not even a checkpoint. It was the home, the owners there, the Forsgrens, had opened it up as a hospitality center. They hung a lantern in the window and said anybody that wanted to stop in was welcome for cookies and stew. And then, of course, it became one of the great checkpoints on the Iditarod. The race did not go through Takotna, went by Tatalina Air Force Base up over the mountain there at the base, and then down the other side. That base is no longer existing. And then there was no checkpoints established between, I mean, you read Craig Medrard's column in the last few days about the trouble the Iditarod people are having,
right,
trying to make it through. Same thing back then. There was not one checkpoint in the wildest section of the entire race between the Kuskokwim and Yukon Rivers. Not one set up ahead of the race.
So, Rod, in the interest of time, I have a couple of questions to sort of lead us down the trail here on the way to Nome. So we've gotten to the point of about the other side of the Alaska Range, if you will, in terms of geography. One question, you talked about very few checkpoints along the way. How did you guys get your supplies out there? Was it literally carrying everything that you needed from one spot to the other? Obviously, they did not have the support like they have today.
No, there was drops at every other checkpoint pretty much for a while, and but certainly dog drops at every other checkpoint. Otherwise, we sent stuff out just like they do today, and it took me 30 days to reach Nome. I only sent out 1,100 pounds of stuff. Today, they send out a ton or more for a 1 week race. And but anyway, I should say that some of us thought we were going to have to hunt and trap our way, or we might well have to hunt and trap our way across the state. Wilmarth and Vent carried a roll of beaver snares apiece, just in case they had to trap beaver. Atla carried a big game rifle. Seavey carried a small arm because he thought perhaps rabbits and grouse would be more likely, ptarmigan. And we just didn't know what was out there at all. The race was what really made the race unique, or one of the things, is the vast, vast difference in the quality and the athletic ability of the teams.
Right.
The race stretched out over 2 weeks between Wilmarth coming in first, and I came in right in the middle of the 34 that started. I came in 17th, and I stayed at Emmett Peters' place in Ruby. I overstayed there so that I could be there to listen to Wilmarth come in at Nome. That's how spread out the race was.
Wow.
And the trail breakers went ahead of the lead teams, and then the trail was just left to the weather. There would be times, 2 or 3 days at a time, when I'd never hear the sound of a plane or a snow machine. It's all alone out there, as if I were making the trip to Nome on my own. And the difference in just doing that without a race is that there was a trail base down there, drifted over a lot of the time, and you could see where it was, so you could snowshoe ahead of the team. And we snowshoed for many, many miles ahead of our teams. But if it blew over and then snowed gently over that, there was no trace. You dare not be on snowshoes. You didn't know where the trail was. You had to wade to be able to feel it down there, say knee deep in snow that was maybe three feet, four feet deep.
Interesting.
And so that made the race string way, way out. And doggone, if you did not have a lot more wood skills than almost anybody that races today, you would be in deep yogurt. I really think, and I think some of the other guys would bear me out, that if today's racing field, who does not have to be expert as far as trail skills, survival skills, because you can leave your cabin on a 100-mile-long training run and come back to your cabin at night, and all you've taught yourself is how to leave your cabin on a 100-mile training run and come back to your cabin that night. And it's not like growing up on a trap line. The teams were just strung out and made you rely on your own woods and trail skills to a great degree. And there was also a great difference in the best, most athletic dog on any of the teams and the least. So I remember Rick Swenson saying one time at the end of a race, one of his dear wishes was that he could have an entire team of really good dogs.
Yeah. And that's definitely a contrast from today, where most of them are quote unquote supreme canine athletes for sure. One more question about your supplies there. What did that look like? Were you guys feeding commercial kibble? What was what was packed in these bags as you're working your way down the trail?
A lot of commercial kibble. And, you know, I think a lot of the natives thought that because this stuff was commercial, it was maybe superior to their own native foods. But certainly it was just pure junk.
Yeah.
Compared with today's races, it was just, I mean, barely able to support some poodle that lived his life on the couch. And I did send out some fat and some grindings out of the meat saw at a local butcher's. I had some of that out there, and the dogs. It was lucky it took me so long to make it to Nome. I had so much trouble with my sled, having problems breaking up, and I have to stop and fix it. That prolonged my trip so much. And that one time stopping for a day to rebuild Terry Miller's sled, all of that really benefited my team, because with the food that they were being fed, it just wasn't correct nutrition. By the second race, man, my dogs were almost gaining weight on the way to Nome. They were so energized. But that first race, we just didn't know.
Yeah. Yeah. You got to learn it's trial by fire for sure. So let's finish up this first race, Rod. Interesting stories for sure. So you said you finished in the middle of the pack there. Bring us on into Nome. Tell us a story or two before we close out the episode about the rest of the race. What did it feel like? What were the emotions going through? Man, you just spent a month of your life out there in the wilderness. Bring us home.
Yeah, yeah. Well, interestingly, every one of us, even the guys way, way back at the end of the pack, we were still racing each other, and every place was important to us. We were all interested in the entire race as a phenomenon. And I remember asking every village as I came through, whose team looked the best? Invariably, it was Isaac's. We were racing back there, and I just kept having these doggone problems with that sled. And and so I was trying to gain on the Ivan brothers. They were... On that first race, of course, there were three two-man teams, and two kind of came to grief. But the Ivan brothers came through just fine. And man, they had a slow team compared with mine, but they were just slow and steady. They had two minds working at once, and they'd never make a mistake. And they ended up beating me to Nome. But anyway, we came in. It was just so amazing. Back then, and for quite a few years into the race, the big deal was, can you make it to Nome? Can you successfully cover the distance and come in by dog team? And so just being able to complete that trip, I mean, I knew before I ever started I couldn't compete, you know, for anything near a top prize, but just being able to finally around Cape Nome and come in. And I recall I was going snow blind, but my doggone Glacier goggles were fogging up. I was being sunburned on the left side of my face by that low sun coming off the snow and ice, and I was freezing on the right side of my face, but I didn't care. I was making it to Nome. And I came in and got some hospital assistance later.
So before we hear about the emotion there, what was it like? How many people were there? Or, you know, was it in the middle of the night and there was two people clapping? What was it like there when you finished?
I came into the last checkpoint, Solomon, and I could have gone on into Nome that night. But the checkers there said, hey, Bud Smith has created this contest to see who can make the fastest time in the Nome. And hey, you know, what does it matter? The guys in back, you can't catch the people in front. The people in back of you can't catch you. Why don't you just stay overnight here? We'll have a nice visit. And you go on in the morning with the rest of the team and see what you can do as far as setting a pace with these five dogs of yours. And so I said, fine, I'll do that. And so I did come in the daylight. And, of course, the finish line was some concentrated Kool-Aid poured across the street in the snow. There was no arch yet. And Mayor Renshaw was there, and every team that came in, virtually every Nomite, would hearken to the fire siren and be down there. So the whole city of Nome, it didn't matter if you were first or last, the race was so strung out, they had to hold three banquets spaced out to be able to accommodate everyone. Nome was so giddy about this whole thing. They were just swooping it up. Bob Evans, I was broke. I didn't have any money to get home on. And Bob Evans, city councilman and an employee of Alaska Airlines, took me in my semi-snowblind state down almost 2 weeks after the winter had come in. The bars were still totally jammed. And I just stood by the doorway while Bob edged in as far as he could and shouted out, pass the hat. And in three bars, we had enough to send me home. And then, being an employee of the airlines, he smuggled my dog team aboard free. And so it was quite a deal in Nome. And I'll just tell you, we racers were giddy. We could hardly believe what we had just done.
So in terms of traditions, you talked about no arch yet. You talk about the Kool-Aid, the fire siren, all of that, the banquets. What were some of the more modern traditions as we know today? Were any of those around? Obviously, there were some prize money. Was there a belt buckle yet? Any of that?
No, the belt buckle didn't come along for a few years until the Burmeisters, Richard Burmeister, came up with the idea after he ran the race. And I can't remember which race he ran first, but, you know, a short handful of races into the Iditarod. And so that was not involved. A group of the racers and I decided that we needed to form a club for people who had done the race. We didn't even conceive then that there'd be anybody from outside. And so we gathered at Galena and formed Anchorage to Nome Iditarod Mushers. And if you look at the patch I created, by the way, the musher on that patch I used a picture taken by the Nazarene minister up there of me coming in on the sea ice on that first Iditarod. I used that for a model of my drawing for the patch. a few sports moxie people over the years have quipped, "Oh, so you're the Jerry West of the Iditarod." But anyway, you'll notice on that patch, it says Anchorage Nome Iditarod Mushers. There were, of course, it was a patch for official finishers, but it was many years into the race before the club decided to call itself the IOFC, the Iditarod Official Finishers Club. It's that's actually a better name for it, but because anyway, I created that. We created the club, and now I'm the last living founder of that club.
So to close us out here, Rod, you're finished. You're getting ready to head home. You said you were dead broke. Do you remember any prize money? Do you have any money in your pocket from finishing this thing?
Yeah, I did. I had $750.
Oh my goodness.
And I think it was something like that, $750.
So you made it back, went back to the real world. We're going to close with that. What did you do when you got home? Did you go immediately back to work? Did you have to lay on the couch for a week to recover or what?
I had taken time out from making my movie, and I had to get back to the movie.
Okay.
And I needed a vehicle. We had been cramming everything into a little Volkswagen Bug, and I needed something bigger. So Alaska was absolutely electrified over that race. And I went down to New Car Sales, which was the Volkswagen dealership back when about every fifth car in Anchorage was a Bug.
Yep.
And I approached them. I said, I don't have a cent. I need a Volkswagen bus.
Okay.
And I said, what? They said, what do you have for, a down payment or any security? I said, I'll tell you what, I don't have a lousy thing but my dog team. What if I put my five finishing dogs up against this vehicle? And they thought that was the coolest thing. And they, the guy at the very top, the president of the whole thing, they went for it.
So your first sponsorship, I guess it would be post-race, right?
Well, I actually had a $550 sponsorship from Alaska Truss and Manufacturing. I got that on the date that I had, after so much frustration pounding Anchorage pavements, trying to get a series of little $150 sponsorships. On the drop-dead date, when I either got a sponsorship or quit trying, I got that Alaska Truss and Manufacturing sponsorship, and that let me go to Nome.
Okay, guys, we're going to end this episode here. What a bunch of stories. This is a awesome little series we got going here with Rod Perry. Rod, it is a pleasure. Folks that are listening, I'm sure you love this stuff. Make sure you hit that follow button, subscribe, whatever you're doing to this podcast, so you do not miss the next episode, because in the next episode coming up, we're going to talk about Rod's second and third Iditarod, and then we're going to lead all the way up to today, to 2026, in our third episode of this series. Rod, it was a pleasure. We'll talk again soon, okay?
Okay, we ain't scratched the surface.
Okay, on behalf of my guest today, this is Robert. We'll see you guys next time. Goodbye.
Are you a fan of the great outdoors? Do you enjoy the thrill of speed and adventure? Then listen up. Introducing Mushing, your ultimate guide to the exciting world of dog-powered sports and mushing. Whether you're a seasoned musher or just starting out, Mushing has got you covered. Get ready to immerse yourself in captivating stories of incredible sled dog races, expert training tips from seasoned professionals, and gear reviews to help you make the right choices for your team.
From the breathtaking landscapes of Alaska to the snowy trails of Scandinavia, Mushing takes you on a thrilling journey through the world of dog-powered sports. Don't miss out on the latest issue, packed with exclusive interviews with top mushers, in-depth articles on sled dog nutrition, and stunning photography that will transport you to the heart of the action. So whether you're dreaming of competing in the Iditarod or simply want to learn more about this incredible sport, Mushing is your go-to resource. Subscribe now and get ready to unleash your passion for mushing. Visit our website at mushing.com or find us on your favorite podcast platform. Mushing, where the spirit of adventure meets the power of the pack.